This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special.
Welcome, Boards Insiders. My name is Christopher Breidigan, and I am the creative director here inside the boards. Inspired by the HBO miniseries Chernobyl, I am pleased to introduce our own miniseries about the events of Chernobyl, and specifically radiation and its effects on the body. Please feel free to follow me on Twitter at ITBsides to see the fun side of Inside the Boards.
Welcome to the Inside the Boards podcast. The podcast dedicated to helping you learn to think like a question writer so you can study smarter, not harder, and succeed in medical school. And now here's your host, Patrick Beeman.
All right, welcome to the Inside the Boards podcast. I am Patrick Beeman, your usual host. Today with me is Dr. Gregory Thompson, who is a radiation oncologist, joining us today to discuss a little bit about RadOnc and radiation. So, Greg, do you want to go ahead and just give us a little intro as far as your background goes?
Sure. Yeah, nice to be here. Like you said, I'm a radiation oncologist. Live in Ohio. I grew up in Ohio, initially grew up in Columbus, went on to medical school at Wright State University in Dayton, and on to residency at the University of Cincinnati in radiation oncology. And I now practice in a large rural hospital in kind of a more of a community practice type setting, but hospital-based setting in radiation oncology.
Yeah, that sounds awesome. And I'm going to ask you a few things about RadOnc as a specialty, but it sounds like you're thoroughly Ohioan, just like me.
Yeah, that's right. I spent about 2 years in Kentucky. My dad is a medical oncologist, and he did his fellowship at the University of Kentucky. So from the age of 2 to 4, I lived in Lexington. And other than that, I've lived in Ohio.
Yeah, and actually, Greg is married to Alicia Thompson, who was one of my attendings during residency at Wright-Patterson/Wright State University's OBGYN program, which is how we know each other. And Greg is also, well, and Alicia, our early contributors to ITB to help us get this thing off the ground. So double thanks in that respect.
Yeah, again, happy to be a part of it.
All right, sweet. So, we'll start out with some, I guess, about RadOnc as a specialty. Why did you choose that?
I guess starting off, RadOnc's a really small specialty. So most, I think, medical students and even residents, probably even attendings, get very little exposure to it. I was fortunate enough because my father's a medical oncologist when I was a second year medical student, starting to think about what types of fields I was going to be looking at as I went into my clinical years. He said that I should shadow a radiation oncologist, which I did in Columbus, kind of going into my third year, and just really loved it. Still went into third year, open to different specialties, but pretty quickly, within probably the first 6 months, realized that that's what I wanted to pursue. Reasons I like it, it's just a nice blend of multiple different things. So I certainly grew up in the world of oncology, my dad being a medical oncologist and my mom was a oncology nurse for years. So I was familiar with cancer, but also because it really is a nice blend of clinical work, technical work, procedural work, and then just blessed to be with patients as they walk the journey of their cancer diagnosis and treatment and, you know, whatever outcome may come from that.
Yeah, totally. And in that practice setting, do you hold clinics? And how often do you usually, say, see a patient as far as like a time frame goes during their own cancer journey, if you will?
Yeah, so we tend to be a specialty that's what I would call like a tertiary referral. So, you know, there's a primary care, and then oftentimes the diagnosis of cancer is made either by a medical oncology or surgeon And then are referred to us. So by the time most, and this isn't true for every cancer clinic, but I think mostly true, by the time folks kind of walk in my door, they have a diagnosis of cancer. And so, you know, what I'll initially do is see the patient in consultation and then, you know, say, okay, yes, you need radiation or you don't. And if they do need radiation, then they'll kind of start the process of planning and designing out that treatment course. Then they'll start on that course, which is usually anywhere from a single treatment, but more commonly somewhere between like 2 and 7 to 8 weeks of daily treatment Monday through Friday. During that phase of their treatment, I'll see them every week. And then after that and follow up, just depending on what they have and how often they need to be seen, for, you know, every several months, for, you know, anywhere for a couple of years to 5, 10 years, depending on their disease.
Okay. Radonc's a pretty competitive specialty. Is that correct?
That's right. Yeah. And it's kind of ebbed and flowed in terms of how competitive it's been over the years. And initially started as a specialty that kind of branched out from radiology. There are some years, I think, where it was really so unknown that it was not very competitive. But as it's kind of come into more of the mainstream, it's become more competitive over the last, I'd say, 10 to 20 years.
Yeah. And that being said, were you a perfect medical student?
No, I don't know what that would even be, being a perfect medical student. But
exactly.
You know, I certainly you know, kind of gave my best at it and enjoyed it. You know, it was different than, you know, previous parts of my life where, you know, when even in college, you're doing college and you're doing extracurricular stuff and you're doing working, where when you get to medical school, you're really able to kind of focus on medical school. At least I was able to. And so, you know, I'd say I did that, but certainly made mistakes along the way. It wasn't a smooth path.
Well, yeah. And I asked that just because usually we end up asking guests if they're willing to share or have any, you know, so-called test-taking failures or problematic academic parts of their medical education.
I'd say for me, you know, probably the biggest struggle that I had is, as you mentioned, the specialty is very competitive and I knew I wanted to do it. But I had gone to a medical school that was really geared towards primary care. There was no radiation oncology residency, so any exposure that I had had to be from outside of my medical school with away rotations in my fourth year. And I went to a relatively unknown medical school as well, so didn't have really a strong medical school name to back me up. My USMLE scores were decent. They weren't amazing. And then I didn't really know anybody in the field. And so I did 2 away rotations. And when I went to apply for residency, those are the only 2 radiation oncology interviews that I got. And so, you know, they were, you know, the statistics, I think, are that you need to be like 8 to 10, you know, interviews for Radonc in order to match. And I had 2. And so I was already thinking of backup plans, but was fortunate enough that Dr. Bill Barrett at University of Cincinnati, who's the chairman of the cancer program there now and was previously the chairman of radiation oncology. He may still carry that title, actually, I'm not sure, but chose to pick me. So sometimes knowing the right people or just falling into meeting the right people and the right path.
Absolutely. So if you were to give advice to medical students, since you guys do keep your specialty so secret, if they were interested in pursuing a career in Radonc, when do they need to start thinking about that? And what would be like the first step? And when I say when, I mean first year, second year.
Yeah. So, you know, there's always days where you can find a day to go shadow somebody. So, you know, that would be the first thing I would do is just go and see if it's even interesting. I had no interest in physics when I was in college. And the fact that I ended up going into a field where, you know, physics is a big part of my job every day is, you know, kind of not something I would have guessed. Let's just say that. But when I went and saw what it looked like in real life, I really liked it. But we had plenty of medical students when I was a resident that came through thinking that they would like it. And they said, no, I don't have any interest in, you know, the physics and the sitting behind a computer and, you know, contouring and doing those kinds of things. So first thing is just to get some exposure to it, see if it's something you're interested in.
Yeah, I would say it, as interesting as your specialty is, and actually I somewhat have thought, man, I wish I would have done that, because I went to residency in OBGYN thinking I would do GYN oncology. And then by the end of second year, I was like, I could not be a trainee another 6 years or something.
Hey guys, sorry for the interruption, but here's a quick message about a new project from Inside the Boards.
We offer you free resources that help you redeem some of your time so you have it to spend with family, friends, and keeping yourself healthy and well. We are launching a crowdfunding campaign because we need help creating our app. Yes, we're like halfway done with it, but we still need a little bit of funds in order to get it off the ground more quickly. Become a part of building Inside the Boards with us. Head over to insidetheboards.com/support to learn more.
And now back to the show. So, Chernobyl, what happened?
The world's worst civilian nuclear disaster took place when a reactor exploded at the Chernobyl power plant in Ukraine, then part of the Soviet Union. Present-day Belarus received 60% of the initial fallout. The radioactive cloud spread further to cover most of Europe. The Chernobyl nuclear power plant was one of the Soviet Union's most advanced facilities. The first two reactors became operational in the late 1970s. The fourth reactor was the newest, going online in 1983. On April 26, 1986, technicians prepared to test the backup cooling system in reactor number 4. But the routine safety drill went horribly wrong. A nuclear reactor is like a giant steam engine. Uranium fuel rods react to produce a massive amount of heat. That converts water into steam, which drives huge turbines to generate electricity. Control rods are inserted in between the uranium to slow the reaction. And it's crucial for cooling water to be pumped around the core to prevent overheating. But as the test began, almost all of the control rods were removed, and technicians lost control of the flow of coolant. Temperatures soared, and extreme heat began to melt the core. At 1:23 a.m., Reactor 4 exploded. It spewed 8 tons of radioactive debris into the atmosphere. 115,000 people were evacuated from a 30-kilometer zone around the plant. The battle to put out the fires inside lasted for 15 days. More than 500,000 military and civilian personnel were drafted to deal with the accident and its aftermath. 31 of the initial firefighters and plant workers died within days from acute radiation sickness. The toxicity of the radioactive cloud was equivalent to 400 Hiroshima atomic bomb explosions. Crews hastily built a concrete sarcophagus to encase the entire reactor to prevent more radiation from spreading. Inside, there remained 200 tons of radioactive fuel. The remaining three reactors continued to operate due to energy shortages in Ukraine. It wasn't until the year 2000 that the Chernobyl complex was completely shut down.
Well, I think that's a good segue. So kind of our goals throughout this series of episodes, they're going to be to kind of focus and draw out some of the medical aspects of radiation exposure, the diseases people deal with in line with this Chernobyl series, which if you guys haven't seen that on HBO, it's well worth a watch. But also to get into a little bit of the basic physics medically related that are important to your specialty, and a little bit on how radiation is used as a therapeutic modality. So if we can start, tell me about, this will be a broad question, tell me about radiation. How does it work? What is it? I guess that may be very broad, but
one of the places I think that's a good place to start is from a therapeutic side, to think about, you know, what are the two major sources of radiation? And that's going to be any man-made or machine-generated radiation versus some sort of radioactive material. And so some of the terminology then comes from that, where for our radiation generating machines, we're mostly looking at X-ray radiation generating, both on the diagnostic side as well as on the therapy side. Just a brief kind of introduction to that. For diagnostic X-rays, usually something in the kilovoltage strength, somewhere around probably 30 to 120, 150 kV. That's kilovoltage. Versus on the therapy side, it's going to be a megavoltage strength X-ray. And so the way that those X-rays behave in tissue is different. The other is radiation material, which is some sort of element that is undergoing nuclear decay and giving off some form of radiotherapy. Generally, the three types that are useful, at least, or part of kind of radiation exposure or therapy are going to be alpha particles, which is basically a helium, beta particle, which is essentially an electron, and then gamma rays, which are equivalent essentially to X-rays.
Yeah, so, and that's part of my interest in this too, because there's a lot of physics words thrown around. They talk about ionizing radiation versus background radiation, and ionizing radiation is the type that makes ions from non-ionic atomic or molecular material, right? That's what, mostly gamma rays?
That's right. So the ionizing effect is a photon, generally, of a certain energy is having a interaction with a orbital electron. And there's kind of two different ways that that happens. One is the photoelectric effect, and one is through what's called Compton scattering. And each of those is different in terms of how we utilize that. But that ability to create a free radical ion then can be damaging to DNA. And that's really the target for me every day is double-strand DNA breaks in tumor cells that are lethal, essentially make that cell unable to replicate and eventually, as it lives out its cellular life, to die by whatever means and not be able to replace itself and continue to grow.
Okay, so if you're talking about a cell, just your run-of-the-mill somatic cell in the body, it's exposed to ionizing radiation. And I guess there could be one of three outcomes. The cell dies, the cell DNA breaks and is repaired, or the DNA is damaged to the point where it can't repair and is mutated. Is that correct?
That's correct. The word mutated there may fall into both the circumstances that you described, option two and three. So there's this idea of sublethal damage with radiation, and that would be generally a single-strand DNA break, which is fairly easily corrected by the cell's innate DNA repair mechanisms. We do have double-stranded DNA repair mechanisms as well. They work better in certain phases of the cell cycle, but generally double-stranded DNA breaks causes various chromosomal aberrations that then are lethal when a cell goes to try to complete mitosis or can even be fatal before that.
So I guess, and I imagine that the amount or dose of the radiation determines the outcome to that cell. Is it kind of a linear relationship?
It's very complicated. So okay. At that point, you have to start looking at both energy as well as the type of particle that's being described. For instance, if you take a photon and the way that a photon interacts in tissue, again, kind of ejecting electrons, most of the then biological events are because of that electron kind of ping-ponging around in that tissue. Versus if you take something like a proton, which has both charge and mass, proton therapy is being used more and more commonly for therapy, that's going to have a different there's the energy deposition of that particle is going to be different than a photon at the end of its range. And so it becomes quite complicated, yeah.
We're exposed constantly to a certain amount of radiation from our natural environment. So every exposure is not expected to result in harm. It's the amount of exposure. It's how much radiation we're exposed to. It's the dose that determines potential health outcomes. I want to talk about ionizing radiation, which is X-rays and gamma rays. So what happens at the higher energy side of the electromagnetic spectrum, these forms of radiation interact with matter. They have enough energy to remove an electron from an atom. And when they do that, the atom becomes charged or ionized. So that's why we call these ionizing radiation, because they have a capability to ionize atoms when they interact with them. This is a unique property that is other, these other forms of radiation, including what we get out of a cell phone, don't do that. So in this training, we're going to focus exclusively on ionizing radiation. Even though we might just say radiation for simplicity, what we really mean is ionizing radiation. So how does radiation damage living tissue? Ionizing radiation can break bonds in molecules, any molecule. Inside the cell, it does the same thing. And as with other toxin, our genetic material, DNA, is the primary target. And radiation can damage DNA directly by interacting with the molecule or indirectly. And that means we have plenty of water molecules in our cells. So radiation will interact with water, break down our water molecules, produce free radicals, and then free radicals will damage our DNA. That's an indirect method. But that's how ionizing radiation can damage our cells. So what happens once a cell is irradiated and is damaged, the DNA is damaged? Well, it can repair itself faithfully to how it was before the damage. So the cell is repaired, and there's normal function, and the cell would go on. Another thing that can happen is that it could misrepair, repair it incorrectly. So the cell becomes an altered cell. And then that cell has potential eventually to perhaps turn into cancerous cell. There's that potential. Alternatively, after the cell is damaged, the cell can die. So cell death is the outcome. And actually, that's not a bad thing, because if only a few cells die, then the function of that tissue is not impaired. And we don't have a potential for a misrepair cell to later on cause harm to us. But if there is a lot of damage, if the dose is high and there's a large number of cells that die, then that impairs the function of that organ. And that's not good. We get organ failure at that point. So these are the three outcomes.
What does the radiation do to them, precisely?
Some of them are exposed. Ionizing radiation tears the cellular structure apart. Skin blisters. Turns red, then black. This is followed by a latency period. The immediate effects subside. Patient appears to be recovering. Healthy even, but they aren't. This usually only lasts for a day or two. Then the cellular damage begins to manifest. The bone marrow dies. The immune system fails. The organs and soft tissue begin to decompose. The arteries and veins spill open like sieves, to the point where you can't even administer morphine for the pain, which is unimaginable. Within 3 days to 3 weeks, you're dead.
Well, let's take a question then. Since most of this is focused on learning the sorts of things in medical school that you need to know for boards. But, I mean, we are taking a different tack here just because this is, I think, more interesting than some of the usual fare that we discuss. But I'll read one of our USMLE-style questions. We have a 27-year-old female brought to the emergency department following a nuclear disaster in Pripyat, Ukraine. After a thorough workup by the medical staff, potassium iodide is administered to help mitigate the damage to crucial internal structures. Which of the following organs is the target of therapy for the administered drug? And our answer choices are A, the spleen, B, the thyroid, C, the thymus, or D, the bone marrow. So based on probably what we just said, the answer is probably obvious that the reason the potassium iodide is given is to mitigate the damage that would occur to internal structures, like answer choice B, the thyroid. So why in this Chernobyl episode or in general, if somebody's exposed to whatever radioactive iodine was in the nuclear power plant disaster, why give them potassium iodide?
It's essentially a dilutional or competitive issue. So by giving stable iodide in addition to the radioactive, that there's a decreased kind of absorption of the radioactive isotope. And the idea there, limiting long-term risk of thyroid cancer or thyroid dysfunction.
All right, gotcha. Can we go through then the basic types of radioactive decay? So alpha radiation, beta radiation, and gamma radiation in general. So alpha, from what I understand, are positively charged particles, and they're large.
That's right. Again, you can essentially think of it as being helium. So there's two protons and two neutrons, so fairly large size. One of the things I didn't realize, but that's how smoke detectors for the most part work. There's a small stream of alpha particles, and just a little bit of smoke can block that stream, and that's what sets off a smoke detector. But alpha particles in general, from a biologic standpoint, really aren't that worrisome or helpful from a therapy standpoint because they have such a high mass and charge that their ability to penetrate is very limited. The only exception there would be anything that kind of becomes absorbed in the body and is able to kind of permeate there. They are being used for therapy. The newest kind of kid on the block in terms of radiobiologics, or one of the newest, is radium-223, which is a kind of similar analog to calcium and is an alpha emitter that's used for prostate cancer with bone metastases only. I guess to take it one step further, beta also has a mass and also has charge, but much lower mass. It's essentially an electron. And so any kind of beta particle in tissue is going to be able to go to a little bit deeper, but you're still talking only millimeters. They had used beta emitters previously for prostate cancer, such as strontium, and they were very damaging to the bone marrow. And so the therapeutic usages were very limited. And I believe strontium, I think I'm saying this right, but strontium 90 is one of the, it has a half-life of, I think, of about 30 years. And that's one of the fission products that was an issue for Chernobyl and still is an issue because it's still present and does kind of act similar to calcium and is absorbed by the bone and kind of limits what they're able to do there at Chernobyl even now.
I did a lot more preparation for this series than I have for others. And I remember a story where they were talking about, I think it was strontium and these radium girls, they were called.
The radium girls. Yeah. There's all kinds of, historical facts about, the dial makers, when they used radium for dials, it was in a factory and it was mostly women. And because they were kind of inhaling the radium, it got absorbed in their bones and they ended up with all these strange sarcomas and various, issues with bone marrow failure and different leukemias and lymphomas and things.
Yeah, I heard they were like licking the tips of brushes when they were cleaning some sort of watch and they ended up getting radium jaw, which sounds terrible.
It sure does, yeah.
All right, so yeah, beta particles, essentially electron. I know radioactive iodine is in the setting of a nuclear fallout, as occurred at Chernobyl, is also a particularly important isotope. But radioactive iodine, that sounds, like something we use for thyroid disease.
That's right. We use two different isotopes of iodine, iodine-123 and then iodine-131. Iodine-123 is used for imaging with a gamma counter and basically is used to see areas of uptake of iodine. And then iodine-131 is a beta emitter that is used therapeutically, generally for thyroid ablation or thyroid cancer ablation.
So there's beta. We're left with gamma radiation. I guess the one thing that I had trouble conceptualizing was this idea that these workers in the Chernobyl factory were exposed to direct radiation when they were very close to the reactor core. But then the real problem was the fallout or the aerosolization of particles that, you know, I guess, if they didn't have radioactive material attached to them, it'd be essentially like ash, right? But affected with radioactive particles, it's ash plus these particles that emit radiation, gamma radiation, beta radiation. And so it gets in the water. People can inhale it. Even the animals who provide, you know, I suppose eggs and milk and things like that could get into the food supply, in which case then you have an internal ingestion of radioactive material, which is not a good thing, I would imagine.
That's right. And I don't know all the specifics of that. I know that there are certain isotopes that are of the most concern. We've talked about two of them, I-131 and then strontium-90. The other one is cesium-137. Which sits on the periodic table just below potassium. That also has an exceptionally long half-life of like 30 years. That's been used for therapy as well. Was used for cervical cancer for years and years and years. But that one, you know, can get absorbed as well. And it's both a beta as well as a gamma emitter with a relatively high energy gamma particle. And so I know that those are some of the things that were the biggest concern, particularly because they're all essentially water-soluble salts. And so, like you said, could get into the water supply and whatnot.
Hey, everyone. Thank you so much for listening. That's it for today's episode. It's the holidays now, and we know as med students you don't have a lot of money to contribute to ITB or really for anything. But we've thought of other ways that you could help us without having to spend any money. So if you're going to be shopping on Amazon this season, please go to insidetheboards.com/shop and click on one of the Amazon links. It takes less than 1 minute, and after you click for any purchase you make on Amazon, we will get a small commission. You can also check out insidetheboards.com/shop for curated items that we thought were pretty cool for the med student, doctor, or whomever in your life. Thanks to Ike Potter, this show's producer, for writing the question content, and to Chris Breitigan, the executive producer for this Chernobyl series. Tell your friends about the ITB podcast and join us next time as we continue this series. Special thanks to Enter Shikari for letting us use Radiate off the 2013 LP Rat Race. Check out Enter Shikari wherever you listen to music.